You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 3, Kidnapping, by R.A. Consul. Chapter 4, Home. The wonderful thing about crossing the bay on the upper deck of the Princess was the freedom from other students. That's the complete list. Everything else about it was pretty poor. It was cold and windy, and the benches were built to endure exposure to the elements with little consideration for the backsides of passengers. A generous person might claim the view was good, but the welded fence, which kept students from slipping into the choppy waters of the bay, obstructed it. Even if it hadn't, the muted colors, scents, and sounds of the Blandlands were uninspiring at their best, and this vantage was particularly bleak. There was nothing to see, nothing to do, and the main form of entertainment was whatever stories Charlie told. The problem with these limited qualities was that they were terribly fragile. All it took to shatter the enjoyment of the voyage was a few students choosing to forsake the warmth and comfort of the interior with the will to ruin someone else's day. In all of Avalon Academy, there was none quite so suited to the task as Evelyn Lemieux Dease. The pile of gray rocks, decorated by a few windswept pines and the leavings of 1,000 seabirds that made up the Blandlands version of Avalon Island, was just in view when the heavy doors to the lower deck clanged open. Stepping through was a collection of the most noble students in Kuro's year, Freya Mimir daughter, Charles Tewkesbury III, Dominique Gauthier, and leading them as always, the embodiment of insufferable perfection herself, Evelyn. She was not quite her typical immaculate vision of beauty, though. In the Blandlands, she was a dull and faded portrait of her Fey realm self. The form was right, full cheeks, curly blonde hair, expertly tailored blazer and kilt, but the polish was missing. Her invincible golden locks were fraying and pale, her radiant snow-white skin pallid, and the deep violet of her eyes had drained away to a shade that nearly matched the overcast sky. She appeared to take no notice of her diminished appearance. She walked as though expecting to be worshipped, and posed as if waiting for her portrait to be drawn. Perhaps the lack of mirrors on the ferry allowed her to imagine that she was uniquely immune to the diluted colors and whisper-thin magic of the Blandlands. She and her entourage strode up to the bench Kuro shared with the new Firefly, whom Kuro had learned was called Jose, and waited for them to celebrate her presence. When none threw themselves at her feet, she slammed her fists into her hips and demanded the attention they were failing to give her.
"There is a rumor that the summer air is on Avalon."
She and her noble hangers-on seemed to expect a reaction. Unsatisfied with the blank and disinterested stares they received, Evelyn demanded,
"Do you know who it is?"
Kuro held back a sigh of frustration. Since ignoring them wasn't having the desired effect, perhaps a bit of flattery would make them go away.
"Wouldn't important people like you be told way before me?"
he asked, hiding his annoyance to appear respectful of their noble titles, which they had earned through the heroic act of having been born to the right parents.
"That is, of course, correct. The noblesse should be the first to know, and it would be treasonous to keep such a secret from them, don't you agree?"
A charming giggle and dismissive wave of the hand failed to mask the mortal threat buried in her answer.
"It would seem that if any were to know such a thing among those of lower birth, it would be the two of you."
She gestured at Kuro and Arthur, who exchanged looks of utter bemusement. Could it be that Evelyn had mistaken their quiet and aloof characters for something other than awkward shyness? Kuro was the first to brave the question.
"Us?"
Evelyn was unmoved by their confusion and assumed it to be a poor attempt at deception. She crossed her arms and turned up her chin so that she might look down her nose at them, her entourage doing the same.
"We have learned that Arthur is a changeling who is in the place of the true heir during the coup d'etat. Do not pretend otherwise."
Arthur let his head fall back and all of the air drain from his lungs. He had tried to keep that fact a secret. Being a changeling was already cause for wizards to fear and distrust him. Being a famous changeling at the center of a mystery wasn't going to help.
He didn't ask how the troublesome rich kids had found out. The answer was probably in the question. They were pampered nobles who got whatever they wanted, whether that was an extra serving of pie or a state secret.
So,
Evelyn continued, not waiting for Arthur to confirm or deny the accusation,
would you be so kind as to tell us what you know of this summer air?
Nothing, Arthur said flatly. How can you expect us to believe that? Demanded Dominique, moving to loom over the boys. He had the features of an Acadian, the dark curly hair and the nose like a carpenter square, but with the height and breadth of an elf, giving him a brutish appearance he enjoyed employing. Talk! I was only a couple of months old when it happened. Do you remember things from when you were a baby? Arthur's inexpressive delivery made it unclear whether his response was dripping with sarcasm or an earnest question. Dominique's failed intimidation unbalanced the brute, and for a moment he seemed to be deciding whether to storm off or throw Arthur overboard. A calming hand on his shoulder from the more composed Evelyn soothed him enough for her to continue the interrogation.
And what of you, Kuro? You were in the employ of Phineas Arne, were you not? You must be privy to his knowledge of the coup?
Kuro's mind raced to work out a way to escape the situation unscathed, while his body sat frozen. He was allowed to say very little about Phineas if he wanted his heart to continue beating. Even with the wispy remnants of magic in the bay, he could feel his pulse slow just contemplating possible answers to her questions. He chose his words very carefully, making sure not to confirm or deny any involvement with or knowledge of his former master. After a length of time that couldn't be considered anything but deeply suspect, while staring fixedly at the horizon over Evelyn's shoulder, he managed to croak out, "Nobody has ever trusted me with any information that important, and nobody I've ever heard discuss the air knew what happened to them." That was the truth of it, too. Phineas had expressed little interest in news of the missing baby and certainly never claimed to know its fate. Kuro didn't expect anyone to believe him. Nobody ever did, and his delivery was even more robotic and evasive than Arthur's. That made it all the more surprising when Evelyn accepted his answer without question.
That is what I expected. Thank you for your gracious indulgence of our curiosities.
She nodded curtly, spun on her heel, and headed for the stairs. Dominique followed her like a deflating balloon, shrinking and sputtering as he went, his planned threats and flexed muscles carried off on the wind. Charles and Freya were left exchanging expressions of confusion with their lessers before they decided they'd rather ask an explanation from Evelyn than try to converse with the riffraff. They made the requisite farewells of highborn folk before evacuating as well. Marie was the first to find words for what just transpired. "Was that weird?" she posed before answering herself. "That was weird." "She gave up really easily," agreed Arthur. "I thought they'd ask us questions all the way to Avalon."
"Or at least call us liars," added Kuro. "She didn't threaten to have me arrested once and barely insulted any of us. I wonder if she's been replaced by a changeling."
"Not a very skillful one, if that's the case," Arthur said. Their commiseration of confusions was stymied by Moira inserting herself into the conversation.
"She didn't argue because she liked your answers," she said with her usual air of superiority.
She waited to be certain she had her senior's attention before continuing.
"They were all promised to the summer air upon their birth."
"What does that mean?" asked Kuro.
Moira cast a pitying glance at her brother's pathetic choice of friends. She would not be worthy of her title as a squire of the summer court if she could not rescue him from his ignorance.
"Tradition holds that great houses from each kingdom will promise a child to be raised alongside a newborn heir. It is a great honor. Those promised children will often be the closest friends of the prince or princess and gain worthy roles in the court. They may end up as seneschals, ministers, royal consorts, sometimes even marrying and becoming true royalty. That does not diminish, however, the true role they serve."
She paused for effect, but Kuro's forgotten neighbor on his bench, Jose, the young firefly who had been subjected to all of this courtly intrigue, demanded she continue.
"What role is that?" he asked.
It was Azalea who answered. Her nose had been buried in a book the entire time, but she relished the opportunity to terrorize the audience.
"Hostages," she said grimly without raising her eyes from the page.
Moira nodded her confirmation of the fact to the scandalized students around her.
"There is nothing more precious to a kingdom than their young wizards of noble blood. With each kingdom holding possession of another's children, it is much less tempting to go to war.
So those nobles don't want the heir to be found,
guessed Kuro, gesturing to where the four interrogators had left for the lower decks.
Perhaps, Moira said. Demoiselle Lemieux, at least, did not seem eager to take up her duty.
Kuro noticed a lack of a voice in the conversation, one that he had not heard since before the royals had graced them with their presence. He turned to see what had become of Charlie, only to be met with a terrifying visage. Her eyes were wide as dinner plates, and she wore a grin so eager he could count her molars. She stared him down with such vicious curiosity that he buckled immediately beneath her unspoken question.
"I really don't know anything," Kuro pleaded, desperate to break the stare that promised to peer into each cell of his brain one by one if he did not spill every secret he knew immediately. "I swear, I told them the truth."
"Ah, you're no fun,"
she complained, while rolling her eyes as dramatically as she could.
"You could have dragged it out a little, at least. There's still ages before we can get off the boat, and you took the only firefly."
Kuro looked to Jose. He was trying to look cool and confident in a way that only a 12-year-old surrounded by older children can. That is to say, he was shaking with the effort of containing unasked questions and in danger from chewing a hole through his bottom lip.
"Why don't you tell him about your farm?" Kuro suggested as a way to escape further interrogation and to help the new kid in a single move.
"That's boring," argued Charlie.
Kuro disagreed and went on to tell Jose about George, the tortoise, in terms that a Blandlander might understand. It was difficult, though. Kuro wasn't very familiar with the makes and models of cars, so he had trouble describing his size. The clumsy attempt had the intended effect of making Charlie take over. Not only had he chosen to talk about what she considered to be the least interesting of the beasts in her care, but he'd done it badly. She overwrote Kuro's version of George as a sleepy, gentle, and patient giant with claims of being a great and noble beast, an armored hulk able to withstand disasters, natural and otherwise. She then explained that George wasn't nearly their best animal. He wasn't even their best tortoise by her accounting. They had a Tarrasque, which was a six-legged, poison-spitting lion turtle. She and Kuro had opposite opinions of what made a creature great. Having lit the kindling, Kuro's work was done. Once started, she could not be stopped, and she regaled them with tales of terrifying beasts she had a hand in raising. Wyverns with venom that could kill a mammoth, mammoths that could topple a fortress, and fortress beetles that had a carapace so thick they could withstand a landslide. She talked about varieties of sphinxes and how they're different from chimeras and manticores. She told them tales of trying to tame beasts whose original owners had neglected or mistreated them, and a harrowing story of an ill-fated flight on a griffin that very nearly killed her. Time slid by quickly with everyone engrossed in Charlie's mostly true stories, though Kuro kept an eye on the approaching island. He had taken responsibility for the Firefly after all, and had to ensure that he got the full experience. Just as they were approaching the shore, he gently nudged Jose, drawing his attention away from Charlie and gesturing to the barren, rocky island the boat was speeding towards.
"You won't want to miss this," he said.
Kuro had timed his interruption carefully, for the moment when a collision with the shattered landscape of the Blandland side of the island seemed inevitable. But not so long before they swept through the veil as to let a fully formed panic set in. A scream caught in Jose's throat as they failed to crash into the rocky shore, and was reclaimed as a gasp when the boat instead splashed through the veil into the Avalon Academy port. The others on the ship had much the same reaction. It was impossible not to. Returning to the Fey realm after an extended journey through the Blandlands was like pulling cotton balls out of one's ears. Doing so straight into Avalon's spring quarter was like having an orchestra start up at the same moment. Kuro enjoyed watching the new student squint and sputter as he tried to take in the whole of it at once. Flowers and colors he didn't have names for. Scents so strong he gagged trying to take them in, but so beautiful that he couldn't help but try again, and sounds so pure that he was immediately lost in the cacophony. That moment was the true reward for taking the trip exposed to the elements on the upper deck. Those below had these experiences piecemeal, the unadorned interior of the ship and the simple grays of the school uniforms helping to make the transition less shocking, the solid walls allowing the students to acclimatize to the mostly milder scents of each other before being walloped by the hurricane force aromas of the island. They didn't know what they were missing. Kuro's return was celebrated by the west wind,
who was much weaker out in the Blandlands, or at least more bound by the rules of that world. She whirled around him, tussling his hair and urging him to join her for a run across the island. The bracelet binding Kuro in place stopped her from pulling him away from the boat, and she nearly pulled everyone else overboard in frustration. In the interest of not starting the year by having anyone hurled from the ship, he exited as quickly as he could via normal routes. His friends quickly dismissed the gust of wind which had nearly landed the lot of them as pavement decorations, and Kuro's rapid departure failed to raise an eyebrow. They were instead fixated on why Kuro had stopped. Each in turn caused a mild traffic jam on the disembarkation ramp when they noticed Kuro still standing in the parking lot, patiently waiting for them. They expected him to already be halfway to Autumn Lodge, outpacing the cars and carriages that carried Chateau and Summerhill students to their residences. He explained that he needed to show their new Firefly to the baggage cart, and that he would enjoy the walk with his friends after a summer apart. His explanations were unsatisfying. The others were more than capable of helping to direct Jose, whom Kuro had abandoned on the top deck already, and they just spent the past few hours locked in each other's company. It wasn't that Kuro was lying. He did want to help the new kid and walk with his friends, but neither was that the whole of it. Running didn't bring him the same joy that it should. It had been his greatest freedom, and now every footfall reminded him of his captivity. The stronger the wind blew trying to carry him forward, the heavier he felt. It was a silly thing, he knew. He could still run. He could still outrun all of them. Even so, it felt as though his heart was moving through molasses. He glanced at the offending bracelet. He could have pried it loose and thrown it in the bay out in the Blandlands. He didn't think the magic would be strong enough out there to explode. But then what? He'd just be given another and probably have to pay for the loss of government property. "It's all good," was all he said to his friends. He couldn't tell them. He didn't have the words for it, if such words even existed. Shame? Grief? Anger? It was all of those and none of them. He couldn't bear them not understanding, or worse, laughing, because he had lost something none of them ever had to begin with. So he kept it to himself. They were freed from Azalea and Moira, who were swept off to Summerhill in a grand sedan, with porters and chauffeurs to prevent them suffering any burden. After they dropped their Firefly and luggage with old Pete in the baggage cart, it was just the four. Marie set an unhurried pace while she talked about her boring Blandland summer, which had mostly involved babysitting her brothers and sisters. Her eldest sibling had just turned 12, and she'd hoped he might have been recruited to Avalon as well, but so far she was the only wizard in the family. She had hoped for her youngest, who was just 7. She was convinced the child must be doing magic, given how she managed to get cookies no matter the shelf they hid them on or container in which they were sealed. The seasons changed slowly as they walked. The blossoms of spring fell away, replaced by the full leaves of summer, which then died and fell as they moved into the perpetual autumn of their home quarter. They could smell Autumn Lodge before they could see it. The scent of fresh-baked bacon and frying bread carried on the breeze. Then, finally, the lodge became discernible from the forest around it. The long, squat log cabin, with fallen leaves piled up to its windows in the perpetual shade of towering oaks and maples, welcomed them with an open door. The four friends didn't take time to appreciate it, however. During the long walk, they had time to forget they had ever left the island. The immobile seasons froze the scenery in time, and their walk was exactly as it had been at the end of every school day. They strolled in and collapsed in their favorite sofa near the crackling central fire. They greeted their classmates and speculated on what the smells emanating from the dining hall might mean for dinner. Demands for quiet circled the room but failed to take root. Familiars either did not understand or pretended not to, and people became impatient, waiting for others to end their conversations, so restarted their own. The reason for their attempts at quiet, which was quite unnatural for the lodge lounge, was Meredith Thrump. She was standing in the middle of the room where everyone could see her clearly. Looming was a better description, as she couldn't help but do so. She was a massive girl, a full head taller and wider than anyone else at the school, with hands that could crack boulders and a jagged grin that could grind them into sand. Anyone who did not know her would be terrified into silence just by the sight of her. Everyone at the lodge, however, did know her, which was making her job difficult. She was the nicest, gentlest, most patient person in the residence, and while she could have easily shouted over the crowd, she preferred to let them settle themselves. All she did was hold up a list of room assignments in a way that prevented anyone else from reading them and waited. When the room was finally still, she began.
Well, it's my senior year, and Pete's put me in charge of the yelling, so listen up and I'll get the room sorted.
Kuro didn't hear anything else she said, because the first words were impossible to understand. Meredith couldn't be a senior. Seniors graduated. Left. Didn't come back. On some level, he must have known it as a fact. The math tallied. She'd been in her first year of high school when they'd met. But understanding it did not at all lessen the impact of the unvarnished reality. Meredith was part of the school to Kuro, and the school didn't change. Not the grounds, or the seasons, or the people. He was so shaken that he nearly missed his name.
Kuro, Arthur, room 13, Meredith boomed.
That announcement was nearly as foreign as the idea of her graduating. He was on the list. Nothing misplaced, misspelt, or missing. His name was there with all the others, like it belonged. That filled him with a warm glow, almost large enough to push out the devastation Meredith's announcement had wrought. He helped Arthur haul his bag into their room and then threw himself into his new bed. It might have been a new room, but everything was just as he remembered. The window was small and a little drafty, the walls raw wood, the dresser too large for the small space and too small for all their clothes. The quilts were heavy, the mattress hard, and the pillows smelled of stale smoke and fallen leaves. He was home.
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.